funny all the while. Years of building my backbone, blown apart by a smile. But what would you say if I told you when we're alone? It feels like
shining sea throughout the solar system and extending to interstellar regions beyond. This is the Kevin Smith Show.
You don't know why. comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. We're here because you have a right to know. And you matter. Well, I hope you had a great, wonderful holiday weekend. Here in the United States, it has been a holiday weekend. It's been a long holiday weekend, meaning that it included Monday. And I hope you had a great time. I hope you stayed safe and that everything is as it should be. If you're brand new, you don't know, by brand new, I mean this, if you've just started listening to the Kevin Smith Show, you don't know about our free weekly newsletter. So let me tell you quickly, we have one. It is free and it's a good one. And all you have to do to subscribe is get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, kevinsmithshow.com, and click that link right in the middle of your screen that says K-Files, and you can subscribe. You'll get a confirmation email, and it's got a link in it that you have to use to activate your subscription, so be sure you do that. We have a number of people that have subscribed and didn't activate their subscription, and guess what? They're not getting it. If you don't activate your subscription with that link in that email you're going to get, then you won't be getting the K-Files. We have to do that to make sure we don't spam people, so be sure you activate it. We are listener supported. I want to thank each and every one of our members who make this show possible. And, you know, it's not expensive to be a member, but it's very, very important to the life of the show, because we don't, I don't play any commercial spots here, and that's by choice, that's by design. We are listener supported. So if you're not a member, it's only 23 cents a day, and you can join tonight, and you should, and I hope you do. Well, there's some pretty big news over in Egypt. As you know, I've done a series of shows about the Giza Plateau. I did a show about the tomb of Osiris, and then I did a show about the underground tunnels and the whole complex of Giza, and then I did a show about a possible connection between one of NASA's top missions in space and the Giza Plateau. Well, NASA has discovered, using satellite photography, 17 additional pyramids at the Giza Plateau. And then today I heard about a new secret tunnel inside and under the Great Pyramid that has just been discovered. And so, well, it's been discovered for a while, but explored. It's been explored with a little rover they sent up in there. So a lot of stuff happening over at the Giza Plateau. Lots and lots of stuff. All of a sudden, maybe I was right. We'll be back right after this.
There's a spin doctor spewing nonsense about UFOs and extraterrestrials who is about to run away in fear. This is the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, I had the microphone on. I guess it's about to go on strike. Well, we will see. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And, you know, I think most of you have been looking forward to tonight's show because I've been advertising that it's coming up, a show on Rasputin. Rasputin, you know, he's one of those figures sort of like Vlad Dracula, the real guy. In that, while most of the world looks at him as being a very evil individual, most of the world looks at Vlad Dracula as being very evil. While that's true, it is also true that in their home area, they are viewed as heroes. In the area there where Rasputin was born and raised in Siberia, he is viewed by those people as a hero, and he was viewed that way during his lifetime by most of them. Some of them didn't like him at all. But a very mysterious figure, and you may be asking yourself, okay, so why are we talking about Rasputin? Because this show talks about, this show deals with UFOs, extraterrestrials, the paranormal, and cryptozoology and space exploration, strange and unexplained stuff. Well, I don't think you can get much more strange and unexplained than Grigory Efimovich Rasputin. And in fact, his name is not Rasputin. It's not pronounced that way. I was talking with a friend of mine down in Texas. And, of course, I am from Texas, so I'm not making fun of Texas. But this friend of mine said, well, who is Rasputin? Well, it's Rasputin. Grigory Efimovich Rasputin. And so you might be saying, okay, well, I understand that you're saying he's strange and unexplained, and that's why you're going to be talking about him. But, okay, who is he? I talked with someone else. As a matter of fact, today I talked with someone age 80 plus. And this person grew up in the shadow of the events Rasputin unleashed on this planet. Grew up in the very dangerous climate unleashed by Rasputin. Had no idea who Rasputin was. It's a disturbing thing, and I'm not going to rant about it, not at all, but it is a disturbing thing that we have so many folks who, and by so many, I mean the majority, who are blissfully, completely ignorant of the world they live in. They are reactors, not actors. They only react to stimuli. When something happens, then they react to it, but they can take no action prior to being prompted by stimuli because they have no information upon which to act. And it really is by choice. It really, really, really is by choice. If you don't know who Rasputin is, and I do, this is going to sound very blunt and very cocky, and I don't mean it that way, but think about this. If I know it, why don't you? This man shaped the world you live in. He shaped history. If I know it, why don't you? Now, there are details about his life that obviously, I wouldn't know because I don't know everything about Rasputin. There are details about his life, perhaps, that you do know and I will provide some details perhaps you didn't know. None of us can know all there is to know about any individual, but to not even know someone who literally shaped the world you live in, and especially if you grew up during the Cold War and you don't know who Rasputin is, where have you been? What have you been wasting your brain cells on? People wonder why we can't get things turned around. You know, things are really, really bad, and why can't we get it turned around? Well, because you keep paddling the same boat in the same river. You have to, you know, you got to get out of the river. You got to look at the map and find out where the other rivers are. You got to look at the lay of the land and the terrain and figure out where you are and go a different direction. But you don't do that. Or I have to say, you don't do that. A lot of people don't do that. Rasputin is a major figure in your life if you're drawing air right now, because he shaped this world that we live in. He's part of the soup we swim in. Now, the name Rasputin, it's a very common name in Russia. And in preparation for doing this show, I've done several things. One thing is I've been announcing that we were going to do this show. I've also, for those who are members, you got an email from me 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it had a link to an ebook, and that ebook was an ebook called Rasputin and the Russian Revolution. That ebook is an important ebook because it was written by Princess Radziwill, or actually Radziwill. And she's a very important figure in this story, although she plays a minor role. She's an important figure because that book gives us more information about the inside workings, the inner workings of the Russian imperial court, the Russian imperial family, Rasputin and his interactions with all of that. And it names names, and it tells who is who and what is what and what was going on. So let's travel back in time and let's see what we can find out about this very mysterious man. Some say more than a man. Some say he was the Antichrist. Some say he was a holy devil. And some people think he was a saint. We're going to travel back in time to a time when the Romanov family still ruled Russia. The Romanovs had been ruling Russia for over 300 years. And at the age of 23, Nicholas II became the Tsar of Russia. Do you know what Tsar means? It means Caesar, which isn't pronounced Caesar, it's pronounced Kaiser. Interesting, because that was also the title taken by the German ruler for many, many years. He was called Kaiser. And you remember at World War I, it was Kaiser Wilhelm. Kaiser was not his name, that's a title. And that, although was a German title with German spelling, that's actually how you say what we pronounce as Caesar. In Latin, it's Kaiser. And Russian, it's Tsar. Tsar is spelled T, well, I've seen it two different ways, T-S-A-R or T-Z-A-R or C-Z-A-R. That's three ways. But it's pronounced Tsar. In Belgrade, there is a bar called Ruski Tsar, which means Russian Tsar. And it's really nice, really fancy. Ruski Tsar. Well, Tsar Nicholas II was married to a German princess, and she took the name Alexandra as her Russian name. They've made movies about them, Nicholas and Alexandra, and oh, it's a love story. But what we learn from this author, Princess Catherine, actually her real name is Ekaterina Radziwill. What we learn from her in her book is that the Tsar and the Tsarina could barely stand to be in the same room. They actually didn't get along. They didn't like each other. Alexandra hated being in Russia. She's the Empress of the Russian Empire. And you have to understand, Nicholas II was the richest and most powerful man on this planet at that time. There was nobody else that had more power. Nobody had more money. This is the richest, most powerful man on the face of the planet. She's married to him, living in absolute opulence. And she hates it. She's got a lot of emotional problems. And, I guess she's living proof. Money isn't everything. She felt she had no friends. And somehow she actually became friends with a woman who lived in town. And she would go to her house and visit with her and just sort of bare her soul to this woman. And she was a friend. And this woman never seemed to be awestruck by the fact that this is the Empress of all of the Russian Empire. They were just friends, person to person, woman to woman, just friends. Out there in the countryside, and I mean the countryside, way out there in Siberia, Western Siberia, there is a very interesting individual. He is a peasant. His name is Grigory Efimovich Rasputin. When he was a kid, he demonstrated that he had some abilities that a lot of other people didn't have. He could talk to animals, for one thing. People in the village thought it was just a child's made-up language, yet the animals responded in amazing ways. He could go into the barn where his father kept his horses. If the horses were for some reason disturbed and agitated, and he would begin to talk with them in this supposedly made-up child's language. And these horses would just calm down and just respond to him as though they understood his language. Now, it was a custom in the village, and still is in a lot of places around the world, that in the evenings, they would meet in someone's home. So they went out and did their work all day, and then they would meet in somebody's home in the village for the evening, and they would sit around and talk and tell stories and socialize. I mean, you know, of course, they didn't have television, they didn't have radio, they didn't even have electricity. And so this is how they would spend their evenings. And one evening, all the folks in the village were hanging out at Rasputin's home. He was just a little kid. And there was some talk about someone had stolen a horse from one of the men in the village. And so, you know, they were talking about it and who could have done this thing, and man, this is terrible. And you have to understand, a horse was not a pet. a horse was a means of making an income, making your living, growing food. I mean, this, you didn't have a tractor, but if you had a horse and a plow, then you could provide food for your family. So this is very important. I mean, this is a major thing. And Rasputin entered the room, and he looked around, then he pointed at one of these men, and he says, "He stole the horse." Well, there was some embarrassed parents, you know. Rasputin's parents were embarrassed, and they told him to shut up and go to bed, and don't be making accusations like that. And Rasputin said, well, let him deny it. He stole the horse. And as it turned out, some of the villagers went to the guy's home and checked, and sure enough, there was the stolen horse. He had indeed stolen this horse. So a lot of people came back to Rasputin's parents the next day and were making the sign of the cross and saying this child has the gift of God to be able to have seen something like that. So, you know, this started at an early age. Well, by the time he was 15 years old, he had these abilities. And you know, he would never, ever steal because he thought everybody else had that ability. And he knew he would be found out. But by the time he was 15 years old, Rasputin, Grigory Efimovich Rasputin, had made a name for himself in his village. And it was not a good name. He was known at 15 as a drunk, a lecher. In case you don't know what that is, that's a whoremonger. In case you don't know what that is, that's somebody that we refer to as a womanizer. At 15, he had the reputation of being a drunk and a lecher and a thug. He loved to fight. He was strong. He was a big guy, and he loved to fight. And there was kind of this gang of thugs in the village, young toughs, you know, and so he was kind of the head of that. They were so bad and so rowdy that the local churches would pay them to stay away on Sunday, so because they created too much disturbance. So he earned his money early with a protection racket. You pay us and we won't disturb your church service. We'll be back.
Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. So Rasputin really had a reputation, and you know, he continued in his thuggery, and he continued in his drinking and lechery. But he always, it was kind of interesting, he always had this sort of spiritual side to him, even though he was involved in all this other stuff. When he was 30 years of age, he became a carter. You know what that is? It's kind of a old world peasant version of a truck driver. There's no truck. There's a cart. And you are, you got some kind of like handlebars in front of you with the attached to this cart behind you, and you push and you carry this cart. I mean, you don't carry it, but you provide, you don't have a horse. You are the engine and the driver. And so that's what he was doing, and he chanced to meet a seminarian who came by and talked with him, and found that Rasputin had much deeper dimensions to him than what the general reputation would cause you to think. And so he convinced him to come with him and spend a little bit of time at this monastery because he wanted to teach him some things. So Rasputin went, and what he taught him was the doctrine of a group called the Kalisti. Now, briefly, the Kalisti are pretty interesting people because the Kalisti sort of made up some stuff and stuck the Bible kind of on front of it and said this is how you get to God. Well, what they did was they believed in what we call flagellation. They beat themselves. And they would meet in secret places, and they would sing and dance and drink and dance themselves into a frenzy, very similar to what you've heard called the whirling dervishes, very similar to that. And then they would collapse onto the ground in ecstasy and engage in group sex. Rasputin thought that was a pretty good deal. And so he took up with the Kalisti for a while. All right, now I'm not going to go through all of the events and everything of his life because, I mean, we could just go story after story after story. And that's where Princess Catherine Radziwill comes in. There are four main players in the story of Rasputin. Of course, there is the Tsar, Tsar Nicholas II, and the Tsarina, Alexandra. Without them, Rasputin probably would not be known to us. But even with them, we wouldn't know much about him without the writing of Princess Ekaterina. Princess Catherine. She was married to a prince. That's how she became a princess. Before that, she was a countess. She got married when she was 15 years of age to this prince, and they lived in Germany. What we know, or what we think we know, about the inside, the inner workings of the imperial court as it relates to Rasputin. What we think we know, maybe we do and maybe we don't. Because Princess Catherine was a bit of a wild child herself. By the way, that's what Rasputin means. It means ill-behaved child. But it's just a very common name. It's a very ancient name. In Siberia, even if you go there today, you'll find people named Rasputin. And by the way, he has descendants living today near Paris in France. But she wrote this book. And it's a fascinating book. I mean, it's one that as I began to read it, it was very difficult for me to stop, even though I was nodding off. I mean, you know, I work 20 hours a day, right? But I cut out some time for me to read and to read this book. And the time that I cut out is like from 3 o'clock till 7 o'clock in the morning. And then I go to sleep and I get back up at about 11 o'clock and start work again. So I just would be nodding off and trying to tell myself, stay awake, because I wanted to read this book. It was a great book. Here's the problem. We don't know if it's true. And the reason we don't know, well, obviously some of it, most of it, is very true. But we don't know how accurate it is when it comes to Rasputin, and that is what the book is about. Because she was a bit of a wild child herself. There was a very famous man back then by the name of Cecil Rhodes. Ever heard of him? You ever heard of a Rhodes scholar? Okay, it's named for Cecil Rhodes. Ever heard of Rhodesia? They don't call it that anymore. It used to be called Rhodesia, named for Cecil Rhodes. Well, he was a real living human being, and she sort of got a crush on Cecil. She ran off and left the prince. She went to South Africa, and she was pretty much stalking Cecil Rhodes. And by the way, she had a couple of daughters by the prince, left them, left the prince, goes to South Africa. She's stalking Cecil Rhodes. And she sent him a letter in which she proposed marriage to him. And, of course, he didn't do that. But here's where it gets really weird now. She forged his name to some bank documents to get money amounting to about $115,000. At that time, the value of $115,000 would be just over $1 million in today's money. So that's a big sum of money. And so the princess ended up doing 2 years in prison in South Africa. And the rest of her life is pretty checkered as well. The rest of her life is pretty, there's some weird stuff in her life. But she was a prolific writer. She wrote a lot of books. This is one of them. And she, right up until just a few hours before she died in 1941, she was in the hospital, and right up until just a few hours before she died, she was still writing. So she was a prolific writer. Much of what we know about the inner workings of the imperial court of Nicholas II and Alexandra, much of what we know about their inner relationships with Rasputin comes from Princess Catherine Radziwill. So with that as a sort of a caveat, we don't know how much of all of this is true, but we can assume most of it's true because there were a lot of people alive at the time she wrote it who had been in the court and knew whether she had been in the court, who had been close to the imperial family. Some of the imperial family relatives were still alive and fled Russia and were out there at the time she wrote this book. So it would have been very easy for someone to say, no, that's not how it was. And it doesn't seem anybody stepped up to say that. She's the one who tells us that Nicholas and Alexandra could barely stand each other. Alexandra would throw fits. I mean, she would just get into hysterical temper tantrums and throw these fits. And things were not going well. Now, they had a bunch of daughters, but they had no son. Therefore, Nicholas had no heir to the throne. And she would just get into these fits of depression and fits of anger. And basically, life in the palace was hell for everybody in the family because of Alexandra. Consequently, Nicholas never discussed affairs of state with her. He would discuss affairs of state with his mother, who had been the Tsarina. But he didn't discuss those with Alexandra, who was the Tsarina at the time. Well, she took exception to this, and it just made things worse. And then she found out that she was pregnant again. Now we'll speed up. It turns out this child is a boy, so he can be the heir to the throne. And now things are wonderful between Nicholas and Alexandra for a little while, because she has produced an heir to the throne. She has produced the next czar. But then as the little boy grows, they discover there's something wrong. And what's wrong is he has hemophilia. Hemophilia is very, very dangerous. The slightest bruise, I mean the slightest bump, that you might get a bruise, but a person who has hemophilia gets a huge bruise, and they may bleed to death internally as a result of it. And this little boy had hemophilia. He was very often very, very ill, at the point of death. And one day, when they thought that he just wasn't going to make it, they thought he was going to die, the local priest, now you need to understand, this is Russia, and so the priest is not Catholic. The priest is what? Orthodox. You don't know what that is? Well, think Catholic minus Pope. No Pope. But the theology is very similar. So the priest is there. Oh, yeah, and their priest can get married. The priest is there because the little boy is very, very ill, at the point of death. And he mentions to Alexandra that he knows of someone who has a reputation of being able to heal. A holy man who has the reputation of being able to heal. So that's what's happened now with Rasputin. He's gone from a 15-year-old drunken lecher thug to earning this reputation of being a holy man. But remember, his doctrine is the doctrine of the Kallisti at that point. He later abandoned it. And it's all about basically group sex. That's kind of where it all heads. However, he has earned the reputation all throughout the countryside there in Siberia of being a powerful healer. So they call him to the palace. We'll be back. Welcome back. Rasputin has now been called to the royal palace of Nicholas and Alexandra. You know, one thing you can say about Alexandra is she was a mother. Maybe she wasn't the best Tsarina. Maybe she had a terrible temper. And who knows, maybe she had a reason. I mean, maybe it was justified. We don't know. She was not liked by the Russian people, that's for sure. She was not their favorite Tsarina, to be sure. But she was a mother, and she was really worried about her son. When the priest suggested that they call this holy man in, she had nothing left to lose. The doctors had given up hope. And so they called in Rasputin. People at the palace were astounded by his appearance. He was shaggy. He smelled awful. Probably was about half drunk because he stayed that way most of the time. But he came in and he knelt down beside Alexei. And you see, Alexei is the reason for Rasputin. As far as the imperial family is concerned, Alexei, the little boy, is the reason for Rasputin. That's why they called him to the palace. And he knelt down and began to talk with the little boy and began to pray for him and began to pass his hands over the child. And then he appeared to be in pain. Not the child, Rasputin. He appeared to be in pain. So he got up and he walked out of the room and he told them he will be fine. The next day, this little boy who was pretty much given up for dead was healed. He was up playing and having a good time and everything was fine and wonderful. He was okay. Now, from that point forward, he had a huge place in the heart of the Tsarina. A lot of people have said that perhaps they had an affair because they were very close. She protected Rasputin against all opposition. A lot of people think they had an affair. Princess Radziwill says that's ridiculous. That there was no such thing as that going on. And she didn't like the Tsarina. And she's very open about that in her book. She did not like Tsarina Alexandra. Nevertheless, she said, none of that kind of stuff was going on. She viewed Rasputin, Alexandra viewed Rasputin as a saint because he had been able to heal her son. And I think most of the mothers who are listening to me right now can, you connect with that. You understand that. If your child was about to die and someone came in and prayed and passed their hands above the child and then said he's healed and walked out, and in fact the child is healed and does not die, you would connect, wouldn't you? You would. You would always have a great space in your heart for that individual who saved your child. And as I said, Alexandra was a mother. In 1912, Rasputin was back home in Siberia, and the little boy became ill again. But this time it was because he had fallen from a horse. And he was very, very serious. The doctors didn't think he would live. Alexandra sent a telegram to Rasputin, imploring him to return at once. Rasputin telegrammed back and said, God has heard your prayers. The little boy will live. He will be fine. Just don't let the doctors bother him too much. And sure enough, within hours, Alexei was okay again. That did it. That did it for Alexandra. From that point forward, Rasputin had access to the royal palace. He could come and go. The imperial family set him up with an apartment in St. Petersburg, and it was furnished, and it was nice. It was spacious, and it was furnished. Now, to make a very long story a little bit shorter, Rasputin has the reputation of being all of the things that a holy man should be and all of the things that a holy man should not be. It's like two different people living in the same body, only they're not separate. I saw one documentary about Rasputin where it was said, you know, he could one moment be praying over Alexei and comforting Alexei and talking about how God is going to heal him, and he could do all of that, and in the next moment be down the street at a brothel. Well, that's not really unlike some of the TV preachers that we've known. But there you have it. That's Rasputin, but he was more than this. Rasputin was not an educated man, but Rasputin was certainly a cunning individual. He didn't have a good formal education, but he was sharp as a tack. And he saw his opportunity after 1912, after that incident where the Tsarina had telegrammed him about Alexei's condition. He saw his opportunity to cash in. And in ways that no one really understands, Rasputin was able to insinuate himself into the upper crust to the aristocracy of Russia. No one, I've read the book by Princess Radzivill. I've read that book, and I've read a few others, getting ready to talk with you about Rasputin. And no one understands how he was able to do what he did. But he had some very, very, very hypnotic eyes. In his younger years, he was not a bad-looking guy. By the time 1912 rolled around, he was a rough-looking character, and it was all due to heavy drinking and debauchery. It had all taken a toll on him, but the eyes remained the same. He had some wild eyes. Now, Rasputin, people would say, you know, well, I'm like, for instance, a bishop from some place or an archbishop from some place would say, well, I am going to have a talk with this guy, and we'll get him straightened out. And he'd go in to talk to him and come out humbled and shaken and weak. And they all said that he had the power to hypnotize people with his eyes. Now, I don't know whether that's possible, but I read some amazing accounts about this guy. I read some amazing accounts about this guy being able to turn a situation around just like that and get his way. We'll be back.
United Kingdom, and you are listening to the fantastic Kevin Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Rasputin, what an interesting individual. He's a mystic. You know, he was, some people call him the mad monk. He was never a monk. Some people think he was a priest gone bad. He was never a priest. There's no record that he was ever ordained into any kind of official clerical position. There's just no record of it. And he didn't claim to be a priest. As a matter of fact, he was pretty much against priestcraft. When he visited a seminary, and he got into a debate in the classroom. Let me see if I can find this. Well, perhaps I won't be able to find it. But he got into a debate in the classroom because he explained to the seminarians, they were talking about sin, and he was saying, you know, look, you guys have got it all wrong. You know, you don't understand. Well, here it is. The priest that was leading the discussion was trying to tell these guys that they needed to avoid sin. And Rasputin said, no, 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 you've got it wrong. You see, sin is indispensable to God because it's very clear from your scriptures that he requires repentance in order to be able to save you and take you to heaven. But you can't repent if you haven't sinned. So it's necessary for you to indulge in sin in order for you to repent. And then once you repent, God can forgive you, and then you can go to heaven. So you got to get all this out of your system first. Okay? So you got to drink a lot. You got to go to a lot of brothels. You got to go to a lot of these group sex things. You got to live it up and sin. And then you can repent, and then God can save you. And so it was quite a discussion. And, of course, the professor took exception to that, and Rasputin thundered at him and made his argument and reduced the professor to sort of a, they said he was stuttering and stammering and didn't know what to say and was reduced to a nothing. So Rasputin had this ability. And now he's in St. Petersburg, ensconced in this apartment provided by the royal family, the imperial family. And somehow he was able to insinuate himself into the upper levels of Russian society. I mean the real aristocracy. They all found him to be rude, crude, and socially unacceptable, except they did accept him. Most of Rasputin's disciples, and he had disciples that followed him around everywhere, were the ladies of the aristocracy. He had large numbers, as many as 30 at a time, living in his apartment. And he made, and there, by the way, there are pictures of him where he's seated there dressed in a priest cassock, although he's not a priest. He's seated there, and there are high military officers behind him having their portraits taken with Rasputin. Amazing. If somebody wanted to get appointed to some government job so that they would have a good income, they could come to Rasputin and pay him some money, and a large sum of money at that, and he would make it happen. If they wanted to be promoted in the military, they could pay Rasputin and he would make it happen. Even appointments as bishops in the Orthodox Church. If it just wasn't going well for the priest and he wanted to be a bishop, but it just wasn't turning out like he wanted it to turn out, he could go pay money to Rasputin. And bang, like that, he would become a bishop. Rasputin literally ran Russia. Now, I want you to listen very carefully to something I'm going to tell you. The richest, most powerful man on earth at the time was Tsar Nicholas II. So how could it be, if he is the richest, most powerful man on earth, how could it be that an uneducated, self-appointed holy man, ragged, drunk, lecher, could be the guy that's running Russia? How could that be? Well, it can be, and it is in many, many countries. The people at the top think they're running something, But they're not. It's the people under them that are making things happen. The president of a company, he may take home a $15 million bonus at the end of a year. But he didn't earn that. All those people under him earned that. They are the ones that made it happen. What does the president of a company actually produce? What does the president of Ford actually produce? Not even a single bolt that goes into a car. And I shouldn't single out Ford, GM, Chrysler, Mercedes-Benz. What does the president of those companies actually produce? Not a thing. It's the people getting low wages, lower wages, far lower wages than the president of the company, who are producing everything he's living off of and enjoying the profits from. And that's the way it is in most governments. So the people at the top think they have power. And this is not a revolutionary, radical theme here. I'm just explaining how this went down. The people at the top always think they have power, but you know, you never have power. You have access to power. You may be able to use and direct power for a while, but you don't have it. No one has power. They get to use it some, but they don't have it. They don't possess it. And the way you know they don't possess it is because when the people under them have had enough and learned to say no, that power's over. Powerful people are only as powerful as the rest of us let them be. So while Nicholas II was out there being the Tsar of Russia and being the most powerful man on the planet, what was really happening down at street level is Rasputin was constantly, each and every day, accumulating and aggregating to himself more and more and more people who believed that they had to go through Rasputin in order to make any kind of advancement in the government, in order to get government contracts, in order, whatever it was with the government, you had to go through Rasputin to get it. He was able to convince people of this, and he was able to enforce it. There were people that tried to buck the system and wound up dead. Rasputin was a pretty bad guy to cross because you could end up dead. The prime minister had accumulated, had done a thorough investigation on Rasputin and had accumulated a thick file of evidence against Rasputin for being corrupt and for being acting against the interests of the emperor and so forth. And he went to the emperor with this file, and he showed it to him, and the emperor refused it all. And the reason he refused it all, included in that, was the people think that Rasputin is having an affair with the Tsarina. That's the popular opinion. They believe that Rasputin is having an affair with the Tsarina. And so the emperor asked the empress about it, and she flew into hysterics and said, "That's crazy. There's nothing to that. He's a saint. And he's just being persecuted. Saints are always persecuted. Those are lies, vile lies." And so, Tsar Nicholas tossed the file. He didn't pay attention to it. But after this incident, Nicholas and the prime minister were together at a theater in St. Petersburg when the prime minister was assassinated. Shortly after he had attacked Rasputin, or tried to. So these kinds of things happened a lot. And Rasputin grew in fame and fortune. He dressed absolutely like a peasant. Hardly ever bathed. His hands and fingernails were always dirty. But this guy had a lot of money. He amassed a lot of wealth. He became rich when he became the advisor and confidant of the empress. All right, now, he began to joke publicly that he could make the emperor or the empress dance to his tune. He began to joke publicly that he could get anything done in Russia. Now, if you'll, I'll dress this up and make it as clean as I possibly can. There was an occasion when Rasputin went out on the balcony of his apartment there in St. Petersburg, which St. Petersburg was, boy, very cosmopolitan and very international at that point. He went out on the balcony of his apartment, exposing himself, if you will, exposing his private parts, and shouting to the crowd below, and he was obviously intoxicated, pointing to his private parts and screaming, "This is what runs Russia." That's the kind of guy this is. Well, the people were getting their fill of Rasputin. The aristocracy, the women, they stayed right in there with him. But the men of the aristocracy were really, really getting to the point where they were saying something's got to be done. Rasputin began to insinuate himself into the affairs of state. He was very much opposed to Russia being at war with Germany. He wanted the Russian army to pull back, pull away, and get away from that war with Germany. This very much concerned the British, because that means if the Russians pull out, now the Germans can unify their forces in one front and not have them split between two fronts, you see. And so they're now getting very concerned about Father Grigory Rasputin, who's not actually a priest. Oh, by the way, he did have a wife and children back in his home village there in Siberia. He left them to go do all this other stuff. He did have a reputation as a healer, not just with Alexei, but with a lot of other people. Beyond that, his reputation was extremely evil. People that tried to oppose him wound up in exile or dead. He was extremely powerful. Now, you would think it would take a long time, wouldn't you? You would think amassing all that power, all that authority, would take a long time. Well, it didn't. It started in 1912, and he was dead in 1916. Just like that, he rose to power. And it happens today. It happens. I watch it at election season. Someone that's absolute unheard of, nobody, and wham, like that, they get elected. It can be for dog catcher. It can be for sheriff. It can be for city council or mayor or senator or congressman or even president. And just like that, it doesn't take long. It doesn't take long. We think it takes many, many years for someone to amass all this power. Rasputin did it with no high school education, probably not even a grammar school education. He could barely read or write, and he did it between 1912 and 1916, and he was excessively powerful. In amongst all of the corrupt dealings in amongst all of his ravings, in amongst all of his debauchery, from time to time he would prophesy. From time to time he would say that this or that will happen, and it did. Sometimes, though, he was wrong. He was dead wrong. He told Tsar Nicholas that this Russian this war between Russia and Germany, it was not going well at all. And he said, it's not going to go well until you go take command of the troops. And so the Tsar did. And it was even worse. Because of following the advice of Rasputin, hundreds of thousands of Russian men died in that campaign. It was a slaughter. So he was no stranger to causing death, but he did make predictions, and we're going to talk about one of those predictions now. The Russian aristocracy, the men, they had gotten to the point where they said, this guy has got to go. And we've tried everything we can to get the Tsar to kick him out. He's protected by the Tsarina. So we have to do something. Well, there was a young prince by the name of Prince Felix Yusupov. Felix Yusupov had inherited the largest private fortune in the world at that time. That was not more than what the emperor had, but the emperor, I'm not including that in that statement, because he's the emperor. But besides the emperor, Felix Yusupov had inherited the largest private inheritance, private wealth in the world at that time. He was a young guy. And he had a beautiful young wife, and they lived in Yusupov Palace. Now, you know, our rich people these days, they live in big mansions. These guys had palaces. And so Prince Yusupov, living in Yusupov Palace with his beautiful wife, the Princess Irina, was one of the conspirators who decided that Rasputin's got to go. And there were, you know, several people involved in that, but they decided upon a plan. Now, there are several versions of this plan. I'm going to give you the one that I think sounds to me to be the most likely. The plan was that Yusupov would invite Rasputin to Yusupov Palace, and the purpose would be, the story that would be told is that Irina, this beautiful young princess, sort of had a thing for Rasputin, and he was going to get a chance to sort of meet her, and who knows where it could go. Yeah, it was Yusupov's wife. But Rasputin didn't care about that, and they all knew that. And so he invites Rasputin to come over to the palace, and in fact sends a car to pick him up. And when Rasputin arrives at Yusupov Palace, well, Irina's not ready yet. So here's what we'll do. We'll go have some refreshments, and she'll be down in a moment. So Rasputin says, cool. And he and Prince Yusupov go down into a basement of Yusupov Palace. And, of course, even though it's a basement, it's still the palace, and it's very, very nice there. And there are some cakes and some wine. And so Yusupov pours some wine for Rasputin, and it's poison. Rasputin drinks it, no problem. All right, now, folks, we're getting to the point, we're getting to the place in this long story that is the reason Rasputin is the subject of tonight's show. He drank the poison wine, and there was no effect. Didn't bother him at all. And I think, and I'm not sure about this, but I think Yusupov poured him a second glass of wine, and there was no effect. It did not bother Rasputin at all. So he gave him some cakes to eat. These cakes had been prepared with cyanide in them. Rasputin eats a couple of the cakes. Now, they're not like, you know, a birthday cake. That's not what we're talking about. You know, they're little cakes, just big enough for one person to eat. So he eats a couple of these, and they're laced with cyanide. It ought to kill him. No effect at all. So Yusupov is really torqued about this and very concerned, and he runs upstairs. He excuses himself, says, I'll go check on Irina, and we'll see if, you know, what the deal is. And he goes upstairs, but instead he goes into his office, where some of the other co-conspirators are waiting. The story goes that he got his pistol, his gun, and left the room and went back downstairs, descended the stairs into the basement, and point-blank range shot Rasputin twice. Rasputin is laying on the floor. Of course, there's blood everywhere. And Yusupov thinks he's dead. So he goes running back upstairs to the co-conspirators and says, I've done it. He's dead. And so they all go running downstairs to see the body of Rasputin. And he's gone. Rasputin had left that basement and gotten out of the palace and into a courtyard and was trying to make his escape. Well, Yusupov and the co-conspirators run over to Rasputin, and they're kicking him and beating him and knocking him back down to the ground, and Yusupov shoots him again a couple of times. But it's not over yet. So Rasputin has now made it out into the courtyard. He's been shot twice. He's been poisoned with cyanide. It had no effect on him. Makes it out into the courtyard. The conspirators surround him and beat him to the ground. And Yusupov fires point blank into Rasputin again. And they think he's dead. But before they do anything else, they do something really gruesome. Yusupov removes Rasputin's private parts. Now, if you think I'm kidding about this, you check this on the internet. His private parts are in a jar of formaldehyde on display in a Russian museum, and you can see that on the internet. And then they take the body and they go out to the river and they throw the body off a bridge into the river, and it's winter time. It's absolutely cold in Russia in the winter time. And they figure it's done, it's over. You would figure a guy that had ingested all that poison would be dead, but he wasn't. Ingested all that poison and got shot twice. Dead, but he wasn't. Beat to the ground, shot and castrated. Dead. And they threw him into the river. A couple of days later, the body is pulled out of the river. The autopsy on Mr. Rasputin showed that he died of hypothermia and drowning. He was still alive. After all of that, he was still alive. Now, before all this happened, interesting prophecy took place. This happened in 1916. There's a little dispute about the date. Some people say December the 29th, some say December the 30th of 1916. But just before this, he wrote his last will and testament to have it delivered to the Tsarina and Tsar after his death, and it was. And it's reported to us by the private secretary of the Tsar. He said several things in his last will and testament. He knew he was about to die. He said he would be dead before January 1, 1917, and he was. December the 29th or December the 30th, 1916. He said now, and by the way, he transferred all of his funds out of his accounts in St. Petersburg to his daughter. And he was a rich man. He said several things about what was coming. He said, now, if I am killed by the Russian people, or most specifically my own people, the peasants, then you, Tsar, and your lineage, your family, will rule Russia another 100 years. But then he said this, if in my death are guilty someone of your relatives, then I tell you that none of your family, none of your children and relatives will live more than 2 years. Now, you have to be pretty sure when you say something like that to the Tsar. Of course, this was not to be delivered to the Tsar until after Rasputin was dead, right? Well, he died on December the 29th, 1916. Of course, this was extremely upsetting to the Tsarina. Some people, again, think it's because she was in love with him, and who knows? But Princess Radziwill says no, not at all, not even close. But it could be because she's a mother. And this is the guy who saved the life of her son that the doctors had said there's no hope. He's going to die. And Rasputin had turned that around. So maybe the tremendous grief and anger that she felt as a result of this killing of Rasputin, maybe it was because she's a mother. And now she fears for her son. Could be. We don't have any way of knowing. But that was in 1916. Things in Russia continued to deteriorate. I heard a guy on the radio the other day explain things this way about revolutions that are happening around the world. He said, when the money stops flowing to the man on the street, the blood will run in the street. Well, that certainly was true in Russia. People were starving. Meanwhile, the Tsar and his family lived in opulent palaces. Those who are watching our TV channel are seeing a picture that shows the entry hall, the entryway, and the grand staircase of just one of the palaces, the Winter Palace. And that's actually the Winter Palace. That's actually one of the palaces of Tsar Nicholas II. They were living in absolute opulence, unbelievable wealth. And people were literally dying of starvation out on the streets. Alexandra was very concerned for her son. She was just worried all the time about her son. She wanted her son to live. But there seemed to be a complete disconnect between the imperial family and their desires for their kids, complete disconnect between that and the people. Because there were mothers outside that palace whose little children starved to death because there was no money, there were no jobs, there was nothing to eat, and they died. That didn't seem to rattle the imperial family much. And things continued to get worse and worse and worse. And the people wanted relief. Tsar Nicholas II was the most powerful man in the world until 1917. When his people learned a very special magical word. His people learned the most powerful word in human language. Do you know what that is? It's the word no. He was the emperor until they learned to say no. He was the most powerful man on the planet until the people learned to say, no, enough. And there was a revolution. And in this revolution, there were people who wanted democracy, and there were people like Lenin, who wanted communism. But they all agreed on one thing, and that is the Tsar has got to go. And so they overran the palace, and they arrested the Tsar and his family, and they bundled them up and took them out to one of the country palaces that they had, a smaller palace. And they held them there. That was in 1917. Now remember what Rasputin said. Rasputin had said, and this is important, he said, if in my death are guilty someone of your relatives, talking to the Tsar, then I tell you that none of your family, none of your children and relatives will live more than 2 years. So Rasputin has said to the Tsar in his last will and testament, which was then delivered to the Tsar after his death. He has said to the Tsar, if anybody among your relatives is involved in me being murdered, then you and your family will be dead in 2 years or less. Quite a prophecy, isn't it? Quite a prophecy. It had to be a little bit scary. But I'm sure that, like most people who think they have power and don't realize they're only being privileged to use power that exists. It just exists. And they get privileged to use it. But they think they have it. And like most people who think they have power, I'm pretty sure the Tsar kind of said, yeah, well, okay. I'm alive, and Rasputin, you're dead. Problem solved. Let's move on. But ladies and gentlemen, in 1917, the imperial family was arrested. They were taken out into the countryside to a smaller country palace. The revolution raged on, and forces loyal to the Tsar were getting close to that palace. Nikolai Ilyich Lenin picked up the telephone and called the guy that was the head of the people guarding the Tsar and his family, and he said, kill them. So, July the 17th, 1918, the Tsar and his family are awakened at night, told to get up, get dressed, you're going to be moved because the battle's getting close to where we are. So we're going to move you. And they ushered them downstairs into a basement, just like Rasputin had been ushered into a basement. They were ushered into this basement, and once they were in this basement, the head of the guard told them, you are going to be executed. Your execution has been ordered. The Tsar gasped, looked at his family, looked back at this guy, and started to say something, and this guy pulls his pistol and shoots the Tsar right in the head. There were 11 other soldiers there. Each one had been assigned one of the family to kill. And they all began shooting, and when it was over, the imperial family was dead. Rasputin said, you won't live 2 years. Your whole family is going to be killed if I am murdered by someone in your family. Well, there you have it. December the 29th, 1916, Rasputin was killed. 1918, less than 2 years, the imperial family was killed. We'll be back. Music did not play. What happened to the bumper music? The bumper music didn't play. All right, we're back, and we have just a few minutes left. Well, there you have it in a nutshell. That's the story of Rasputin and the imperial family. A lot of lessons in this. A lot of lessons for politicians in this. You may be somebody, you think, one day. You may be rich, and you may think you have power. One day. But if during the night the people learn the word no, you're finished. That's a lesson for people in leadership everywhere. Politicians, presidents of companies. It's those little people out there that make you. It's the little people that are the big power. There's a lesson in this as well. For our genre, Rasputin. Rasputin had pretty well documented abilities in the realm of what we call the paranormal. You've seen the Star Wars movies, and you've heard the Jedi say, may the Force be with you, and they've talked about don't turn to the dark side. Well, without getting into philosophy or theology about the Force, the fact is that all of us have abilities, and all of us, like Rasputin, have choices to make. And Rasputin chose at times to use his abilities for good, but most of the time he was turned towards the dark side, and he didn't win. part of his prophecy, ladies and gentlemen, was that if he was killed, I read you part of it about how the emperor and his family would die. But he also says what will happen to Russia, and he says it will descend into brother against brother, bloodshed against brothers. There will be, you know, the churches will be destroyed and defiled, and he paints a very bleak, apocalyptic kind of picture for Russia if he was killed by one of the family of the Tsar. And he said this will last three times 25 years. Well, I don't know if you're aware of it, but he got it almost right, because what he unleashed lasted for 73 years. Three times 25 is 75. What he unleashed, or at least helped to unleash, lasted for 73 years, because what happened was Lenin took over. The Bolsheviks took over. There was a very brief period of time where there was a democracy, but then the Bolsheviks just bullied their way in and just took over. And the communists ruled Russia from the 1917 revolution all the way until 1990. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. There was a problem with the recording of the last 15 minutes of this show. I was able to recover all but about the last minute and a half. Well, there was nothing really earth-shaking in that last minute and a half, so essentially you've got the whole show. I hope you enjoy it.